Hi, my name is Nikki Anderson and I'm Director of the Feminist Writers Festival. Welcome to this podcast of our FWF 2020 session, Intersections of the Law, made possible by Creative Victoria. Here, lawyer and activist Fernanda Dahlstrom, transgender advocate Sally Goldner, and Human Rights Law Centre senior lawyer Monique Hurley discuss the pressing issues for women and non-binary people of all backgrounds in fair and equal access to legal justice. We acknowledge that this recording took place across Australia on First Nations lands, lands whose sovereignty has never been ceded.
Welcome to the Feminist Writers Festival, everyone. My name is Meg Dench, and I'm on the board of FWF. Today's session is Intersections of the Law. This conversation may discuss violence or other content which causes distress. If it raises any issues for you, we ask that you seek help such as via 1800 RESPECT or Lifeline on 13 11 14, or whichever professional support you may have in place. Now, please, let me introduce our wonderful panel today. Fernanda Dahlstrom is a writer, editor and lawyer. Fernanda has worked as a solicitor in criminal law, family law, child protection law and domestic violence law in the Northern Territory and Queensland. Sally Goldner's 20-year plus involvement in Victoria's LGBTIQA plus communities includes Transgender Victoria, 3CR's Out of the Pan and Bisexual Alliance Victoria Treasurer. She was the 2015 LGBTI Victorian of the Year, joined the Victorian Women's Honour Roll in 2016 and received an Order of Australia in 2019. Monique Hurley is Senior Lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre, where she works advocating for all people behind bars to be treated with dignity. Monique has previously worked as a lawyer at West Justice and the North Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency. Please now let me hand you over to our Chair, Monique Hurley. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Megan. Hi, everyone. I'm Monique, and I am a lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre. My pronouns are she, her, and for our visually impaired friends, I'm a woman in my early 30s with long brown hair, and I'm wearing a top with some bright yellow flowers on it, coming to you today from my living room. And I also want to acknowledge that I am zooming into today's session from the unceded lands of the Kulin Nation. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. I think it's particularly important in a session on intersections with the law happening during NAIDOC Week to acknowledge the role that the law and the legal system plays in enabling systemic racism to continue and to frustrate true justice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And so on that note, we're here to talk about intersections with the law, and I'm feeling very privileged to be here with Sally Goldner and Fernanda Dahlstrom. I'm going to start by asking each of you to tell us about your first or most formative experience with the legal system and what you took away from that system. And so starting with Sally and then jumping to Fernanda.
First and foremost, I acknowledge that I'm on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, and acknowledge my local people, the Bolan Bolan, which according to my references, translates into Bolin and originally meant lyrebird, and from the nearby Bolan Bolan Billabong where I am. I'm around 20 kilometres from the mouth of the Yarra Yarra River. I use the pronoun she, her. For those who are visually impaired on the Zoom today, for myself, I'm wearing a red and black patterned dress, a sort of silver rope style sort of high necklace, three badges, one in the rainbow colours with the black and brown stripes, a bicoloured badge which says visibility, B with the emphasis on the BI, and a trans-coloured badge which is appropriate for our discussion on law reform. I support trans birth certificate law reform. And in the background, I have three flags of the rainbow communities, the pansexual flag, which is dark pink, yellow and blue, the rainbow flag, and also two signs, which say save the bisexual whales and save the pansexual whales. I would very much acknowledge we're in NAIDOC Week, but I think if I may, we're also in Trans Awareness Week, and I have the colours of the trans flag, the pink, white and blue, and it's also very functional because you don't want to know everything in my study. It covers up the coat rack. And my first encounter with the law, I think the first one of note was 1998, and I had only recently affirmed my gender identity full time. I was in my first accounting role in as my authentic female self, and it was proving stressful. There have been things I hadn't been told about the role, and so I decided to try, in line with the last panel, I tried to do some self-care and took a lunch break. I went out, got some lunch, sat in my car near a park. I'm sitting there minding my own business, beginning to unwind, eating lunch, listening to some music on the car stereo, and just sort of also glancing at a magazine. And all of a sudden, there's a knock on the side window, content warning, sort of reenacting excessive masculinity and probably queer phobia. What are you doing here? This is a park inhabited by pedophiles. The clear implication was because I looked weird, in inverted commas, that I was a pedophile, which was pretty appalling. I tried to complain to the then, ironically named Police Ethical Standards, now equally ironically named Police Professional Standards, to be told, oh, that was Sergeant so-and-so, he's a good family man, gee, thanks, I really needed to know that. And they said I was looking at children walking by while I was eating lunch and looking at a magazine, so I don't really know how that's that could be the case, but that certainly wasn't my words. So it didn't leave me with a good taste of police and policing in terms of diversity, and it goes, the whole attitude goes so much to, in a sense, a sort of toxic masculinity, aggressive attitude that we sadly have seen so much this year, both in lockdown and in other things. And, well, Monique, you and other great people in the community legal sector work with it on a day-to-day basis. And I know Fernanda wants to talk more about it as well. But it's toxic masculinity in a sense of misuse of power, not just in terms of body or gender, but all sorts of things, neuroprocessing, other things, which I think is a theme that we want to explore a bit, fair bit today.
Thank you for that, Sally. And over to you, Fernanda.
Thanks, Monique. Just to begin with, for the vision impaired, I'm a woman in my late 30s. I've got short brown hair. I'm wearing a blue top and I'm standing in my lounge room. I'm zooming in from Brisbane, which is unceded Yagara and Turrbal country. In terms of my earliest experiences with the law, I had a lot of early contacts with the criminal justice system and the prison system, because I grew up in the care of a single mother, and we, until I reached the age of about 8, we had quite an ordinary, fairly middle class life. I understood that she was making her living by running quite a successful business as a language consultant. We were living in the bush, in a rural area outside Ballarat, and I was going to a private school, Ballarat Grammar. My mum was quite highly educated and intelligent and ethical type of person. We were both vegetarians. We spent most of our time when we weren't at school and work reading. And then one day when I was 8, I got out of school and found out that she was in jail. And for me, that came as totally without any foreshadowing or context. And what I was told was that she had been charged with credit card fraud and stealing or something along those lines. I can't remember the precise charges on the first occasion, but I was given to understand that she was innocent, and that it was a setup against her. And she was in jail for a couple of weeks on remand, and then she got out and we went back to normal. And then 6 months or so later, it happened again. And that was just the beginning of a pattern of her being in and out of prison for fraud and other property offences for the rest of my childhood. She got out for the last time when I was 18 and hasn't been in trouble again since then. So at the time, throughout my childhood and adolescence, I believed that she was innocent and that it was all a setup against her. And spoiler alert, that turned out not to be the case, but I didn't discover that until many years later. But I did have a lot of contact with a lot of the criminal justice system from a very early age. I started visiting her as an 8-year-old. She was in Fairlie Women's Prison, which was one of the main prisons in Melbourne at the time. And when you visit someone in prison at that age, you're allowed, and you're their child, you're allowed to go in right into the prison and to spend an entire day in the prison, and you have access to all the areas that the prisoners have access to. So I became quite familiar with prison life and with prison customs and with some of the situations the other women in prisons were in. So from a very early age, I was aware of things like the traumatic practice of strip searching women on a regular basis when they're going in and out of court, or before and after visits with families. I was aware of the very negative effects that was having on women, particularly those who'd been through sexual assault and abuse. I was aware of things like the regular suicide attempts in the prison, people not getting adequate access to their kids and to their families, to other services that they needed. And I also heard about and witnessed a lot of very gratuitous bad behaviour by police and prison officers, including directed at me as a child. So it was easy for me to believe my mother's claims about her entire situation being a setup, because I saw so much of the unpleasant underbelly of the criminal justice system, and it was easy to believe that the people who were doing these petty cruelties on a day-to-day level were also involved in this large-scale conspiracy to jail people for things that I hadn't done. After I became an adult, I eventually looked into my mother's past and the things that she was imprisoned for, and discovered there was an abundance of evidence that she did, in fact, do the crimes that she was remanded and eventually sentenced for over that decade, which I think was a surprise only to me. Nobody else had been taken in with her claims of it being a conspiracy. So my perspective on the criminal justice system has shifted a lot since that realisation, but my early observations about the many other forms of injustice involved in the criminal justice system and in women's prisons stand unchanged, and I my realisation that my mother was guilty of the offences she did time for doesn't in any way change or belittle the real injustices that she was subjected to as a women prisoner. So, sorry, long answer.
No, that's okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. And so you went on to become a lawyer and have spent a lot of time working in the law and writing about the law, and particularly its impact on women. Your essay references that the incarceration rate for women is increasing much faster than men, and I was hoping you could talk us through why the rates of imprisonment for women are really skyrocketing at the moment.
Sure. So I guess there's two parts to that question. The first one being, why is the incarceration rate skyrocketing across the board? And the second being, why is it increasing so much faster for women than for men? The overall incarceration rate has increased by something like 70% in the last 10 years. And it has been due to changes in sentencing practices, changes in bail practices, and changes in policing practices. In the last 20 years, there's actually been in Australia an overall decrease in the overall crime rate, but there has been an increase in the incidence of particular types of crime. There's been an increase in drug-relating offending. There's been an increase in minor property offences, theft and what have you, and in public disorder offences. There's also been introduction of mandatory sentencing in a lot of states and territories. So in a lot of jurisdictions in Australia, if you're found guilty of certain drug offences and under certain circumstances, the court doesn't have a discretion not to to impose a custodial term. Also, in the last couple of decades, there's been a lot of changes to bail laws and bail practices in the different states and territories, and a lot of it's been in response to public pressure that occurs every time a serious crime gets committed by somebody who's on bail or somebody who's on parole or on a supervised order or whatever. And there's this perception that the crime has occurred because of a failure in the legal processes that allowed them to be living freely in the community, which really isn't the case in a lot of instances. In a lot of instances, the person was put through the correct procedures and was the correct decision was made by the decision maker at the time with the information they had. But with hindsight being what it is, everything seems obvious in hindsight. And so there's people calling for violent offenders not to be bailed, and that's led to it being harder and harder for people to get bail and people being granted bail on much more arduous conditions. So courts have been empowered to impose bail conditions that require people to complete rehab programs, for example, if it's drug or alcohol related offending, that require people to have a fixed address, which makes it hard for homeless people to succeed in getting bail, And it's also becoming a lot more likely that people are going to breach their bail because of unrealistic bail conditions being imposed that people are not able to comply with. So in terms of why the overall prison population is growing, a large part of it is because of a huge increase in the number of people being remanded. We've now got a third of our prison population is actually composed of people who are on remand, which is much higher than the percentage in comparable liberal democracies like the US and the UK and New Zealand, and it's more than twice what it was here in the 90s. In terms of why women's incarceration rate is increasing faster than men's, that's a phenomenon that is seen internationally, not just here. There's no definitive answer to it. There have been a number of hypotheses put forward as to why it's the case, and they are that essentially changes in policing practices and in sentencing and bail practices are disproportionately impacting women because of the circumstances under which women typically are charged with offences and sentenced to imprisonment for offences. Police have become a lot more punitive in the way they respond to public disorder offences in the last couple of decades and also to drug-related offending, and which are both categories of offences that are more likely to be committed by women. And I guess a personal anecdote from my own practice that comes to mind on this is about 10 years ago when I was working as a duty lawyer at NAJA, which is the Aboriginal Legal Aid Service in the top end of the Northern Territory, one Monday morning I saw a lady in her 60s who was in custody in the cells. She'd been flown in from the community of Nullumbor, and she was a lady who had maybe one or two very trivial entries on her criminal record 20 or 30 years earlier. She was not a habitual criminal by any means. And what had happened was she had been caught stealing two bottles of alcohol out of somebody's outdoor fridge, and she'd been summoned to come to court in Nullumbor, and she'd failed to appear on the day. So a warrant had issued for her arrest, and the police eventually found her in the community, and they found her when court wasn't sitting, because court only sits every second week in Nullumbor. And rather than just summoning her to come to court again the next time court was sitting, they took her into custody, flew her to Darwin, kept her in the cells over the weekend, and then brought her into court on the Monday, where I pleaded her up and she got released without penalty in consideration of the fact that she'd spent 3 days in custody for something that you would never get 3 days in custody for. It was a very trivial offence. And that, to me, just really exemplifies the illogical and punitive approach that police take to really minor offending. Another factor, I think, is the way police respond to domestic violence allegations. Commonly, when a woman contacts the police with a domestic violence allegation and the police come out to the scene and the woman says, my partner's bashing me, and the man says, no, she's bashing me, rather than trying to get to the bottom of what has actually occurred, the police will just take out reciprocal domestic violence orders in favour of each of the people, so each of the partners. And usually when you've got a domestic violence order, there's a condition that you're not allowed to assault or harass or abuse the protected person, but there are also often other conditions on those orders. And when alcohol or drugs is involved, a common one is that you're not allowed to have contact with the person when you're intoxicated. And if you have an order like that taken out against you in relation to your partner, the chances of you breaching it are pretty high. So I think practices like that are also a factor in why women are being criminalised at a higher rate than they were.
Thank you for that. And now, Sally, just to bring you into this conversation, your essay talks about legal issues that are often faced by trans and non-binary people, and that includes laws and systems that deny identities. Can you please speak to some of the legal issues faced today by trans and non-binary people and comment on whether you think the law is properly equipped to grapple with intersectionality?
Trying to do a summary answer there, it is, well, slowly moving in the right direction, but very slowly, and then we start expanding, say, beyond Victoria, Australia, and into a world setting. And there's so many things that come to mind, and one which bounced off Fernanda's comment was not so much in relation to domestic violence, but I'm thinking back to the to a performance done by Selena Jenkins in a Fringe festival a few years ago, a wonderful performer, about my home, and you know, it goes through all the homes that Selena and maybe with partner had lived in, and then they bought this wonderful place in the hills to the east of Melbourne and started facing homophobic harassment from a neighbour, and all the police could say, well, you could put a camera up and catch them or something, that sort of thing. And it's sort of, in a way, paralleled what Fernanda was saying, that police are often not equipped to deal with these sorts of more human issues like intimate partner violence and family violence and queer, I'll use broaden and go queerphobic harassment, which then links to your question, you know, how it comes across for us. There was also the situation some years ago of a trans woman who was taken into custody and her previous male name was still on record, so she had to hold up the plate with her male name and features on it. And whilst it's not, I suppose need to be a little cautious here, whilst it's not ultimately proven that the situation earlier this year at St Kilda Police Station with Dean Laidley was transphobic, I would be willing to bet money that had Dean Laidley been arrested in a shirt and trousers and no makeup, there would be less chance of those photos being sent out. So I think that there is, again, there's this underlying macho and simple language element or gender derogatory approach to gender that police face, and that certainly comes across for trans people. There's also the issues for trans people broadly that some have reported during the lockdowns of the pandemic this year, that while they were going out for totally legitimate purposes such as food, exercise, medical care, that transphobic neighbours were falsely dobbing them in, which means you've then got to interact with police who aren't helpful in the first place, and you know, it creates more stress on more stress on more stress. So there's some, just some, only a few of the sort of day-to-day issues that can happen broadly, and in, you know, in this unprecedented year. the broader systemic issues that can happen, well, the faceplate type of thing touches on that, that it can be challenging for people to, in terms of cost and process, to change first the name on their documents and then the marker. Whilst, we did have the birth certificate laws coming in force in Victoria on 1st of May this year, and I'm deliberately looking away for a second. I cannot put my birth certificate that says female away in a drawer. It's in a frame on my desk because it means so much to me, which is wonderful. Not everyone can afford that. Yes, there is some support out there. Worth mentioning that Transgender Victoria, thanks to a donation, has a fund for people who can't otherwise afford to change their name. Probably worth mentioning that. But of course, some people may not have access to that, the connections in, those sorts of things. And we still have three states and territories where birth certificate laws are, my words, way below pass marks, so to speak. New South Wales, where it's still surgery-based, Queensland, although one would hope with the re-election of the ALP government up there and a clear majority when Greens support that we could get some movement, and they only have the one House of Parliament. Western Australia, where the last I heard laws were stuck between the two houses, where it had passed the lower house but not the upper house. Other things that can happen, the constant lack of clarity around sport for trans people and the unfairness that trans women face. And whilst it's not my lived expertise, would acknowledge that intersex women obviously can face that, such as Castor Semenya and Dute, that this whole gendering of it's not so much law, but, the laws that define people in inverted commas. And also, whilst there are laws, of course, they've got to be put into force. And we see so often in general issues in generalist and specialist healthcare, where even though there are laws, people will not obey them. And yes, in a great report by Lucille Kerr from La Trobe University, I want to say great, it was well documented, but it's sad that some of the things were talked about. For example, of a trans man who went in for an operation that would be relevant for someone who was assigned female at birth. And even though the person had changed their name, was living as male, some nurse said, well, you came into this world as a woman, I'm referring to you as a woman, that sort of thing. So we can have laws, but they, can't necessarily, it's about getting them into practice and making people aware of them. And often so much of the discrimination in healthcare and policing and laws can be on a very one-on-one basis. And, it's a sad society where we feel like we have to walk around with a webcam on our head to capture these things and have proof. So there's a combination of day-to-day systemic laws and practices, also where laws aren't make it difficult in practice, say for people who are homeless. And, so much of accommodation is gendered. We've seen a wonderful advance by Vincent Care with their Ozanam House in Flemington Road, which now has single rooms with a shower and a toilet each, which gets past some of those issues. But people will say, well, I'm just enforcing the law. Where's your birth certificate? Now, I don't know. I've never been homeless, and I would acknowledge that, but I don't believe that a homeless person would be carrying around a copy of a birth certificate, even if they could have one that was, reflected their sense of gender identity. So there's all these sorts of issues which affect marginalised people, and of course once we put more intersectionalities in, that will make it worse. And I'm also thinking here of trans sex workers, which is why we need, say, decriminalisation of sex work. I know there are campaigns in Victoria and Queensland run by peer-based sex worker groups as well. So, and many trans people are, have made a conscious and informed decision to do that form of work, as have cis people as well. So there's all the intersectionality factor, I think, in line with the title of our session, I think is really relevant here. The more that you can, more that you face, and sadly, whilst we want to treat everyone respectfully, police who maybe have these limited and limiting attitudes about power and curiarchy, to use that word, won't do it. And then there's issues in court systems as well. And I was hearing in a discussion with one of my colleagues during the week, some issues that perhaps court support workers need some more information to be supportive as well, though you know, I'm aware there's a lot that can be good as well. So there's all these structural issues, and of course we all know of the more money you have, that when it comes to court, the more chance you have of getting the outcome that's for you. So trans people who are already facing disadvantage, adding in the intersectionality, can face these issues both on the ground day to day and in the structure of our legal systems and practices.
And so pivoting now to more of a kind of models for change and looking towards the future, your essay talks about the need to ensure that the law and the people and processes that enforce it fully understand concepts like equality and equity. Can you talk us through what you mean by that and any ideas you might have for getting there?
Yeah, so when I think of equality and equity, there's the various slides that the first edition I saw was the one that started out of the three people of varying heights. They've given one, been given one box each to stand on, trying to look over a wooden board fence to watch a sports game. And the second frame, which talks about equity, says, well, we'll rearrange the boxes so that the tall person who can then just see over the fence doesn't need a box, the middling person still one box, the shorter person two. And that's helpful, although, as I always say, there are two things. One, how does that short person get up onto the two boxes? Do the other people have to get out of the way? Does someone lift them up? And if I can just have one moment of dry humour, as a trained accountant, we shouldn't be standing on rickety wooden boxes. That is terrible workplace health and safety. But then there's the one with the third meme, which says, oh, let's get rid of a board fence and just have a cyclone fence, which gives some protection, but now people can stand on the ground, don't need any boxes, get rid of the barrier. Now, first of all, I acknowledge that meme may have some ableism. It may not be perfect. It doesn't solve everything, but I think it's a great representation of what we're trying to achieve. What are the barriers to being more inclusive? Is it making laws that affect birth certificates easier for people to access so they don't have to have surgery or they're not costly, those sorts of things? Is it training, healthcare, and then coming right directly to your question? One of the things that I find frustrating is that police procedures, for example, such as the more detailed and more recent incident that I put in my essay about the traffic officer, that these procedures are not designed in conjunction with the public, but that's who they're supposed to serve. I think we know how, you know, one-sided and heavily weighted the scales are tipped to, police, policing, including police union and to court systems. And so, you know, we hear a lot, and we've heard some wonderful sessions today involving lived expertise. Well, let's bring in the lived expertise of those who have been through these systems, what went wrong, how it could be better, and maybe what has worked, so we can reinforce that and get that engagement in there. Now, call out the elephant in the room. There'd be resistance from some people to that. I can almost hear those sort of earlier style of police being interviewed on talkback radio. These people don't know what it's really like out there. Well, I disagree. I think that having that expertise would make it easier for police to do their job. There'd be more trust with police from all parts of the public if we started having that sort of engagement where people had some sense of ownership of the systems and structures. And also court processes. Well, ironically, my accounting background comes in again. I mean, a court system that was designed for commercial transactions 500 years ago really is perhaps not quite right for human issues like intimate partner violence, discrimination, harassment, vilification, those sorts of things. How can we take those processes so there's less stress on the people who are on the receiving end, or similar words like victims, survivors, and that it is fairer? I mean, I just find it ridiculous that, you know, so many of these sexual harassment cases get thrown out, you know, that all the people who come forward can't all be wrong, and, you know, so many other things as well. So how can we make these processes really more fair, more respectful and more equitable so that the barriers to justice in this case, we get take down those wooden boards, to use the analogy, and perhaps can, you know, sort of get to that third meme where everyone's on level ground would be a much better approach. And it's just about having those systems treating users with equality and respect, which is the basis of good interaction for any interaction at all between people.
In your essay, Fernanda, you quote the great abolitionist thinker Angela Davis. Can you tell us what abolition means to you and why you think it's important?
Sure. Well, abolition is the belief that rather than trying to reform the prison system, we should be working towards minimising and eventually completely eliminating it from society. It has its origins in the United States, where the penal system has its origins in the slavery system with its very obvious agenda of racism and capitalism. And it is more important than ever to countries like the US and Australia at the moment that are going so much in the wrong direction in terms of the expansion of the prison industry and the rising numbers of people getting incarcerated in circumstances where the crime rate isn't even on the increase. I think abolitionist theory is an important reminder that we do need to be working to not only oppose the privatisation of prisons, which we've been seeing increasingly since the early 90s in Australia, but also with opposing prison wholesale as a remedy for most forms of crime. I think the fact that we have seen such a lot of change in the last 20 years in the wrong direction in terms of more prisons being built, the privatisation of the prison system and more people going to jail is actually evidence that change is possible in response to changes in government policy. And if that negative change is possible in such a short space of time, it makes sense that change in the other direction would also be possible if the right policies were implemented.
Thank you for that. Now, I'm just looking at some of the questions that have come in. And one of the questions, I think, is for Fernanda. How can we reconcile the lack of structural supports in prisons with rehabilitation, especially for a woman who is being released after a lengthy sentence?
That's a great question. I don't have an easy answer for it. It is the ultimate irony of prison as a solution to anything, isn't it, that it is supposed to be rehabilitating and yet we don't provide any rehabilitative services or very few to prisoners. And people coming out of prisons are almost always in a worse situation than they were when they went in, and much more likely to re-offend than they probably would have been if they'd been dealt with in some other way. So I guess I would say it's not about reconciling it. It's about opposing. It's about opposing the prison system and opposing that paradigm of dealing with criminal justice in a punitive way and in a way that others, the disadvantaged people who are fall foul of the criminal law because of their circumstances, and coming up with more humane and more constructive ways of dealing with those people by supporting them through early interventions, through providing services at the time that they're needed before people get to the stage of facing jail because they've committed offences. So things like mental health services, drug and alcohol services, affordable housing, all those things that are so crucial to keeping vulnerable communities from being criminalised.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you for that, Fernanda. Another question that's come in is there anyone doing it right? Hopefully, are there any examples of initiatives inside the justice system that you would point to here or elsewhere? And I'm thinking, Sally, is that something that you would like to comment on?
Look, I think there are good people, and I suppose, you know, I suppose a start where I can dive in here is the essay that I put up, a very aggressive traffic police officer. And I suppose there are people fighting individually in the system, and after it seemed like this was a lost cause and suddenly I and one of the people who'd given me a letter of support in that situation get a call from a female police officer in charge of the relevant district of traffic, who was quite wonderful. We did, as we would have done this year, a Zoom. And she starts by, once we've settled the Zoom and unmuted, sort of, she then says, look, I'm feeling really anxious in front of people, someone like yourself and the other woman, who I won't name out of privacy, because you're people who are very prominent in your communities. Now, that sort of vulnerability, that's just being honest to Ray. And the first thing that she says after that, I've reviewed the police officers who made contact with you, and their behaviour was, I think it was inappropriate, over the top, and one other word, which was a pretty good start. So I think there are people trying their best in the system. One person who I do remember who's not in Victoria Police anymore was the second lead of the LGBTI liaison office, Scott Davis, who was a very, I think, an honest person. But I think it's trying to get through this systemic stuff. And, of course, we saw it earlier, impossible not to mention the Four Corners show earlier this week with, the height and depth of the, if you like, of this systemic power is trying to get things to be more systemic. So there are other things, that are happening well in terms of courts and law. I mean, there are some police reference groups, but I think that this core macho element of police, say, for example, is a problem. There are some good practice examples and people fighting, but there is good work slowly being done, chipping away. Also people such as St Kilda Legal Service and the Roberta Perkins Law Project for trans people as well. But it does seem like we've taken the top off a few weeds, so to speak, in terms of power imbalance. Now it's time, how do we start uprooting and getting that, and putting some of the plants we want into this system, so to speak, to use a metaphor, I think is the challenge. And I think what this conference is a start, and how we can network so groups facing similar things, whether it's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, LGBTIQA+, many others, can perhaps work together, because I think there are obviously a lot of common threads, might be a way where we can work through that.
Yes, the Roberta Perkins Law Project does really incredible work, and I can see that the Feminist Writers Festival admin has posted a link in the chat, so I encourage everybody to check that out.
Could I also just say something on that, Monique? There have been some really successful trials of justice reinvestment in Australia and around the world. I don't know how familiar people are with that phrase, that term, outside of the legal profession, but justice reinvestment is a way of dealing with criminal offending where money is diverted away from the criminal justice system and back into the communities that have produced the offenders. So in the town of Bourke in New South Wales, they've done it really successfully. There's a number of articles and videos about what's been done in Bourke with justice reinvestment. If you look them up, I should have included them as my online recommendations. But they've had really, really good results in a fairly short space of time with targeting specific types of offending and their root causes. Like one thing that they did was, there were a lot of people getting charged with driving unlicensed. So they started giving, they raised money to buy a car, and they just started giving free driving lessons to people who wanted to get their license. And the police started volunteering their time, giving people driving lessons, which improved the relationship between the police and the community. And this was all at the initiative, I think, of the Aboriginal elders in the community. And they've seen a really significant decrease in a number of types of offending. So, yeah, look that one up. That's a heartening example of something that's being done right.
Thank you for that. There's been a few questions that have come through on abolition. And Fernanda, do you have any idea how seriously current governments around the world, or even just in Australia, are taking abolition? Is it really on the table, or is it seen as too radical a concept?
I don't think I've seen any example of governments taking it seriously or even discussing it, but there are strong abolitionist movements in a lot of places. And there are community organisations springing up that are informed by abolitionist values and principles. So there are a lot of people working hard to try and reduce the prison population, if not governments actively trying to do it.
And Sally, do you have any thoughts on abolition?
Yeah, I think for a lot of, I'll say, inverted commas, rabbities, so-called criminals, I think that, you know, abolition would be incredibly helpful. Yes, if someone is, for example, a cold-blooded gangland murderer, yes, we need prisons there. But when we're talking about the sort of things that, you know, we've heard, you know, Fernanda talking about how women who retaliate against male partners are incorrectly, you know, sort of face intervention orders and that sort of injustice, then, you know, abolitionism, I think, has a strong place, that so many offenders are there through perhaps disadvantage and poverty, and we need to redress also the, in conjunction with abolitionism as well. I think that, you know, we need to look at causes, not symptoms, so to speak. Why do we have so many, you know, why do we have some of the trends we've mentioned? Why are, you know, marginalised groups like mental health, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and others facing disproportionate crime? Well, let's redress the problems and then maybe we'll be preventative. So I think that the two can go hand in hand, and that we can, you know, sort of get down the amount of, you know, people in custody and only have those who really need to be there, who, you know, really need, really done some, say, vicious things, rather than people who are just there sort of in a way through desperation and disadvantage. So, yeah, I think there's a strong case for abolitionism, and even more so as part of a holistic picture that just takes things on their merits rather than instantly going tough on crime and those sorts of, well, overused cliches.
Yeah, I think abolition is often spoken about as, you know, a way to reimagine a future without prisons, and thinking about how we might work, you know, as lawyers and advocates with that in mind, and working towards that as the end goal. And I think that that's, you know, increasingly becoming an important way for us to view the work that we do in the criminal legal system. We've got some more questions. One for Fernanda is, how has the privatisation of prisons impacted on the treatment of people in prison and the criminal legal system more generally?
Well, it has led to, I think, a falling of standards and also a decrease in transparency and accountability. And the most obvious example of that I can think of is the death of an Aboriginal elder in Western Australia about 8 years ago, I think, who was being held in one of the private prisons in Western Australia and was being transported from between the prison and the court. And he was being transported through the desert in very hot conditions, and he died of heat exhaustion in the paddy wagon. And it wasn't possible to ascertain how much was actually known by the people who were who had custody of him, of the fact that the air conditioning was malfunctioning in that paddy wagon. And that's something that would be verifiable if it was a correctional facility that was government operated and that was covered by freedom of information. I also think there's just a profound conflict of interest in a private company operating a correctional facility that is supposed to be rehabilitative, when its ongoing existence and profit depends on maintaining a robust prison population.
Thank you for that, Fernanda. And for Sally, you mentioned neurodiversity in terms of treatment within legal systems. Is that something that you could please expand on a bit?
For sure. It's something that I'm becoming or increasingly equally passionate on, along with LGBTIQA+. So neurodiversity, neuroprocessing, our brains, you know, process information in different but equally valid ways. Basic one, some people are introverts who get their recharge time by themselves. Some are extroverts who like recharging with other people. And because, of course, we have to get rid of binaries, there are ambiverts, people who like bits of both. And we probably all are, to some degree, ambiverted. So it's the idea of a spectrum. So for me in particular, the one that interests me, the trait, the highly sensitive person, and that's really important to me because, in plain language, highly sensitive people process sense all sorts of information in greater length, depth, and breadth than the median of the population. And advantage of perhaps working from home. So if I reach down here and pull out these keys and rattle them, that rattling for me is almost, you know, like a bomb going off, whereas for some people it's just keys rattling, that sort of thing. So going back to the incident I described in detail in my essay where this police officer eventually pulled me over and started going, well, you have the right to say no comment, but kept saying, asking these questions. So why did you do that? Why did you do that? Why did you do that? As someone who is has this trait, that is really intense, whereas for someone else they might be able to remember to take deep breaths or something, and I'll go into a sort of, you know, fight or flight mode to some extent. And so I think this really has to be taken into account in all our justice systems. An area, and it's important for LGBTIQA+ people, in particular trans, in that the other large area of neuroprocessing is autism. And we've found a significant overlap, to keep it simple, between trans and gender diverse and autism. We don't know why, but it just seems there's a lot of trans and gender diverse people on the autism spectrum. I've heard of surveys where the centre of the intersection is trans, minimum 23%, others 29%, but people who work on the ground, particularly parents of trans and gender diverse children, say it could be 50%, and those figures are too cautious. So therefore, we can't ignore that. So what do all these things mean? I think that the issue of police are trained to treat any side of anxiety or nervousness as guilt. Well, that's not really right. You know, if someone's really going at me, going, why did you drive past me on this road or whatever it is? And I'm, you know, that's going to cause me to flinch. They're going to think, oh, this person's guilty. Well, no, I'm just really stressed. I'm also a trauma survivor from the, you know, toxic masculinity that I endured in the first roughly half of my life. And that sort of toxic masculinity that they're doing is really going to put me out, put me off, and or throw me off balance. And therefore, we need to be aware of all those forms. Now, I don't claim to be an expert on autism. It's not my lived expertise, but I also understand that one factor could be that people on the autism spectrum like very direct language, and if you use metaphors or cliches, that can be problematic. So it is about being aware of how we communicate, and really using plain language is probably better for lots of people. I mean, people who have a first language other than English, those sorts of things, you know, could be very much more helpful as well. And I think we heard a bit about that in terms of long-winded terms on the medical panel this morning. So same thing in a way. So, yeah, I think neuroprocessing really needs to be taken into account, and that police need to get that sort of retraining so that that assumption doesn't happen. And it also comes into the broader assumption that, you know, there's a whole range of situations for police. Now, yes, there might be difficult, threatening situations for them where some intense action is needed, but given that the vast majority of police interaction is with innocent citizens, there'll be some civil offenders, such as someone who's speeding or whatever, and some criminal offenders. I think there surely has to be a way we can train police to be aware of this so that the average citizen, including neurodivergent citizens, do get that respectful treatment. greater, better interaction and ultimately building better trust with police and the law and the criminal justice system.
Thank you for that. We have another question, and I'll get Sally and Fernanda to both answer this. Has COVID-19 and living through the pandemic changed your perception of the criminal legal system in any ways? And if so, what might they be? And I'll start with you, Sally.
Okay, I wish I could say otherwise, but the COVID situation has lessened my, or reduced my sense of how I view, it's less positive, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. And we saw so many of these things with the enforcement of lockdown laws, the silly situations of one that happened was two people who were from the same household walking in a park, someone else stopped to ask them directions. Well, before they know it, police have come over, oh, you're all not from the same household, you're having an illegal gathering, fine. And it's just that sort of misuse of power, and there's been so many others, as they were coined early on, the again, trying to put a little bit of dry humour in, the kebab boffins, as they were called after the case in New South Wales. That sort of stupidity, the people who were trying to, they had a horse to feed, they had to go more than 5 kilometres, they were fined. Well, if they didn't feed the horse, they probably would have been given a fine by the RSPCA or something. It's just this lack of common sense, and it's just, again, this misuse of power. One of my best friends, who I'll just say is a cisgender woman, regardless of sexuality, has had no major direct interaction with police, but she felt nervous going out of home because of the way police were behaving. She'd had an indirect an interaction once where she rang a police station and asked for the LGBTI liaison officer and was just told, yeah, you don't need to talk to them. No, this is an LGBTI issue. No, you can't talk to them, which didn't probably shape her perception. So there've been some of the things in my immediate circles. But when I hear of some of the other things, people who needed to access the injecting room in North Richmond, who that is a health issue, and, they've been fined multiple times. And, of course, there'll be possibly multiple intersectionalities going on there, such as homelessness, for example. And it hasn't really been impressive. And although things have happened during this year which haven't been lockdown related, such as the content warnings here, the outcome of the horrendous case of the 6 police who interacted with a disability pensioner and the slap on the wrist fines, I won't go into perhaps graphic detail, that they got slapped on the wrist rather than really all 6 of them should have been given a very stiff sentence, probably some thrown out. We've seen the outcome of the initial IBAC investigation into the hares and hyenas invasion. So many other things. And I know it seems so long ago, and I'd better definitely say content warning here, the situation of the police officer in Queensland earlier this year, late February, early March, before lockdown happened, and his victim-blaming type remarks on, the family who are no longer with us because of the horrendous situation of family violence. It's just been a lot of them. And it is incredibly saddening and disheartening that, this is happening. And so I haven't been left with a good impression, and I haven't seen a willingness to investigate this. I mean, when the dust settles and, we are seeming to be going the right direction and fingers crossed for vaccine, I think there has to be some sort of official investigation into these sorts of misuses of power where things can come forward, people can come forward safely without fear of retribution, tell these stories, and more to the point, what do we do to change these systemic imbalances? I think we can talk about them a lot, but how do we then get that interaction going so that we do get the systemic change we need? And, I know Fernanda will probably have lots to say, and I've also just seen a question come up that's sort of in relation to that. So throw it to Fernanda.
Yes, Fernanda, if you would like to add anything to that, and also I'll give you this to throw into the mix as well, if you could have Australian police forces change one thing tomorrow in how they operate, what would that be?
I saw that question in the chat and I got a bit distracted by it. I think I would probably say the one thing I would like to change about the police is I would like the police to have some level of education or life experience before they joined up. At the moment, the way I understand it, most police join up when they're 18 or 19. They generally don't have a degree or a lot of experience in any working in any other field. And there's a traditional culture, a culture of lack of transparency and of blokiness within the police. There's a code of silence which requires you not to blow the whistle on colleagues even if you know they've done the wrong thing. And I think it must be incredibly difficult for a young person going into that culture, even if they have the best of intentions, to stand up to their older and more senior colleagues, even when they know they're in the right. I think if they were required to do some other work or study first, they would be better placed to resist that culture and to help establish a better one.
Thank you for that. The other part of the question that I'd posed to Sally was whether COVID-19 and living through this time has changed your perspectives on the legal system.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Sally said about seeing some really silly police practices, silly and punitive and counterproductive practices by the police in enforcing the letter of the law in relation to COVID regulations rather than doing things like responding to domestic violence allegations, which were through the roof when we were in lockdown. I think the only positive development I saw during the lockdown was the courts starting to be a lot more open to people dealing with court matters remotely. And I know that sort of cuts both ways in that some people may have issues that they would prefer to air in person in court, even if it is just an administrative listing, a contest mention or an adjournment or whatever. But I think for a lot of people it probably had a lot of advantages, especially for women with little kids, not having to go physically to court with all your little kids in tow, for people with disabilities and mobility issues, transport issues. I think that was probably an advantage, and I hope that's something that the courts retain in the future.
Can I just do a quick bounce back off that? One thing that came to mind was many trans people, if they were in a safe home environment, said they didn't have to worry about finding appropriate toilets everywhere. Now, yes, when we are in person, we need to make sure we have them, but they said they weren't worried about having toilet issues or being misgendered or anything, and they could feel safe in their own home. So I think one of the things that I think is beginning to emerge as we're beginning to see some light at the end of the sort of pandemic tunnel, is I think there'll be things we can take out of this year that will go forward and we can get a better mix for lots of people. So, it's then just a matter of thinking through how can we can keep applying that to the criminal justice and court system so it is a greater win-win for all.
Thank you. We've got just 5 minutes left in this session, and there's one more question that's come in, and I might get you both briefly to speak to it if you have any ideas. But the question is, are there any examples here or overseas you're aware of where the sort of systemic overhaul of police culture and policy needed has been achieved, or at least there's been progress in the right direction? Maybe starting with you, Fernanda.
That's a fantastic question, but I'm sorry, it's not something I've looked into, so I don't know.
Do you have anything to offer on that front, Sally?
I think there is one, declaring my long interest in the Victorian Police Community Encounters program, and that's been jokingly described as a, a cross between a living library book and speed dating, in that, for each batch of new police and PSO recruits, obviously this was pre-COVID, that people, and I'm not sure what happened during this year, but people would go out to the academy in Glen Waverley, and there'd be, say, one person from diverse communities, because, of course, we are intersectional, who would sit with, say, four or five recruits at a time. The recruits would ask questions about themselves, their interactions with police, naturally right to decline to answer or point out inappropriate questions. And I think that has done some good work, again, declaring my interest as someone who was involved in it for a long time. There were all sorts of biases and unconscious biases that got uncovered, and, as someone who was involved frequently for a long time, it did do some good. Where perhaps the problem lies is that your middle-ranking police, who can be the proverbial crusty veterans, such as people who run the stations, and who have that day-to-day operational influence from middle ranks, perhaps haven't been exposed to that. And so the newer police coming through are sort of facing that, brick wall of attitudes, or brick ceiling, if we can call it that. So I think that if that program could be extended to existing police, and perhaps maybe police do a bit of a refresher of it now and then, and be encouraged to do that as part of ongoing training, that would be seen positively if they did that. I think that's one good program where police have, I think there's one good, that is certainly one good program that has worked very, very well. And I also did some work myself a few years ago now with federal police in the ACT, who seem to be doing well on at least LGBTI issues. I can't talk for more intersectionality. So there are these things out there, but it just seems like in, the last few years, maybe they've been pushed back a bit. So that they are there. We've got these sporadic examples. It's how, I suppose, we can make them more widespread. Again, length, depth and breadth of criminal justice.
I really hope the use of technology, like how Fernanda was talking about earlier, in terms of if it's someone's preference to be able to use technology to access court, or particularly in prisons, people being able to have visits remotely has been something that a lot of people in prison have found to be good, although, that really needs to be an option and shouldn't ever be a substitute for in-person visits. That should, we hope will resume in Victoria soon in the prisons. Just to wrap up, I wondered if Sally and Fernanda wanted to recommend something for the people zooming in today to go away and read, starting with you, Sally.
Ooh, I think that because it's something that perhaps doesn't get talked about, I'm going to recommend some of the resources and reading I had on neuroprocessing, because I think this is something that doesn't get enough discussion. So, the website HS Person and all the books there, The Highly Sensitive Person and all the books that come in there, books on introverts, which, is similar-ish. There can be a lot of depth of processing books, Susan Cain's book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Never Stops Talking, although the other introvert books that I read earlier, Introvert Power and Introvert Advantage, are good, and say that introverts appear very extroverted and can't stop talking when we're passionate about something like diversity and social justice, which I think I've done a bit this afternoon and loving it. And so I really recommend people look at those books. And I don't want to for a second deny extroverts. It's like all forms of diversity. If we value all of them and what they bring, and, in any setting, then we get the best out of everyone. So I'll go with those ones for me.
Awesome. And anything that you would like to recommend to read, Fernanda?
I don't have any specific titles, but I could recommend people to look into what's been written about justice reinvestment and the trials that have been done of justice reinvestment. Because although abolitionism may not be getting discussed seriously by governments, but justice reinvestment does to a greater extent, and it is the first step along that process.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that. I invite everybody now to join me in thanking our incredible speakers, Fernanda Dahlstrom and Sally Goldner. Thank you all for being part of the Feminist Writers Festival for 2020.
We hope you enjoyed the conversation. Our thanks to the speakers and chair, our podcast partner Listen Up Podcasting, Creative Victoria, the Beeson Family Foundation and Queen Vic Women's Centre for vital funding support. For more FWF goodness, visit our website, feministwritersfestival.com, and find us on socials.